4, which is next door, and there will be a prize for the best question from the audience. Panelists today are Steve Mosby, Helen Fitzgerald, Chris Ewan, and Douglas Lindsay. I'm not going to give you their biographies because they're in the programme book, but what I have asked them to do by way of introduction is to write the first paragraph of a book featuring an animal protagonist. From comments on Twitter, I believe that I may live to regret this. But I'll start off with Helen.
Okay. There's an F word to come, so apologies.
Sorry,
although I've been told never to apologise for swearing, but I am sorry. Right. Her husband hanged me from the rowan tree, said she needed to let go of her attachment to me. You can't replace the real world with that fucking bunny, he said. At 10 o'clock tonight, he found me in her secret place, took me out into the garden, looped a string around my neck and hanged me while she banged on the window of her locked bedroom. It's after 11 now and she can still see me. She stopped screaming, but she's crying, hands touching glass as she watches me go. I'm not dead yet and she knows it. She can see my ears quivering, less and less rampant as the insides of me flatten. I'm going now, I say with barely moving ears. Her husband has unlocked the door. Come on, he orders, come to bed. He has no settings, this murderer, no buzz, no matter where or how hard she presses. She kisses her fingertips and touches the glass. Arrivederci, my rabbit, she says, my every time dead cert. I must go and endure the real world.
Thank you. Douglas.
Okay. No one ever knew his real name. They called him the Ringmaster. And now he was dead, his body crushed and battered and broken in an attack that was bestial in its ferocity. His killer, in a final act of diabolical brutality, had slit open his stomach, sucked up his innards, and then sprayed them around in a bloody 50-yard radius. The lungs, somehow containing the last vestiges of air, bounced into a far corner. The heart rolled over beside them, leaving a trail of aortic slime in its wake. It was nasty, but it was the Glasgow way. When the deed was done, years of humiliation having been avenged, his killer returned to her small caravan where her clothes and all her possessions were neatly laid out in the bed, ready to go. And so it was that at 4:37, on a June morning that had already dawned warm and bright, Nellie the elephant packed her trunk and said goodbye to the sex.
Thank you, and I hope everybody had a nice breakfast. Chris?
This is the start of a fly vendetta thriller. I was a fly in a glass. There was water inside the glass. There was a throwaway coaster on the end of it. The water was sloshing around. I was sloshing with it. This was on account of the movie that had been playing on a TV over the bar. Not a bad movie, except for one scene, a scene where some guy drowned a fly in water and then brought it back to life with a sprinkling of salt. Now every chump in the bar wanted to drown a fly. Every guy wanted to produce a little magic with some salt, and I happened to get the goof who was just a bit dumber than most. He gave me a real good shake, a real thorough drenching, like I was in a washing machine, like I was in a toilet flush. Then he dumped me on a napkin and tipped half a pound of salt over me. I wasn't crazy about this guy. I was buzzing mad. First thing I did when I came round was I gave him the finger. Flies can do that. Maybe you didn't know. Truth is, flies can do a lot of things. They can mess with you in all kinds of ways. I was going to mess with this guy, and no amount of salt was going to help him.
Steve.
I apologise in advance for this. This is the beginning of an action thriller in which the hero is a sexually transmitted infection. As Corporal Green discharged his final remaining rounds at the army of antibiotics advancing on his position, he glanced down at his fallen comrades and was forced to accept the futility of his struggle. I'm a goner, he thought to himself. I'm a gonorrhea.
Thank you. share their own less than glowing reviews. Start with Douglas.
Oh, okay. This is from the 2nd of June 2001. It was written by Gerald Kaufman in The Scotsman. I presume it's Gerald Kaufman. In the service of Scotsman readers, I am ready to read anything, even something as dire as A Prayer for Barney Thompson by Douglas Lindsay. But I wish that so many of these books, good as well as bad, would not be so long. This third in Lindsay's noir comic series about a Glasgow barber suspected of serial murder, which began delightfully and has now degenerated into almost total unreadability, goes on and on for more than 400 pages.
Thank you.
The worst thing is he then reviews about another 9 crime novels and likes all of them.
Steve.
Yeah, I thought I'd read a sampling from my Amazon reviews for my first novel. So let's just have a look at some of these. I read this book a few years ago when it first came out because I quite like the idea of a British author. Well, what a disappointment. The book is badly written with flashbacks and disjointed scenarios, and the characters just swear for the sake of it. And then there is, having eventually finished the book, I feel disappointed with the loss of time it took me to read it. While the overall topic of the book is dark, the author seems to just flit across death and killings and instead tries to over-darken the whole rape-torture topic. A very muddled book, written like the author was half drunk while doing it. And my favourite one, this is an unusual book with a basically quite gripping storyline, although the subject matter is quite disturbing. I found myself skipping over a lot of Mosby's rambling flashbacks and descriptive stuff to cut back to the main story. And if you can keep your attention on the main track, it's a good read. 1 star.
Chris.
This is it's from the Albuquerque Books Examiner, which, funnily enough, I was able to find my worst review ever quite easily when Donna mentioned it, by somebody called Faith Acker, who... She doesn't start well because there's a picture of my book, it's The Good Thief's Guide to Paris, which she calls throughout the review A Good Thief's Guide to Paris, which was interesting. She's obviously not a fan of mystery fiction because she slams that in her opening paragraph, sums up everything you need to know about it, but I won't tell you that. She goes on to say, although Chris Ewan, author of A Good Thief's Guide to Paris, does not quite rank with the greatest mystery novelists of all time, which, A Good Thief's Guide to Paris lies well on the upper range of mediocrity. Then in the middle paragraph, she likens my books to the Nancy Drew mysteries. And then she says in her final paragraph, aside from its self-conscious insistence that we laud Ewan / Howard for the clever self-conscious internalisation on display throughout the story, A Good Thief's Guide to Paris is actually a very clever little story about art forgery, art theft, picking locks and murder. The plot contains some obvious loopholes and the foreshadowing is so strongly painted that most plot twists are not truly surprising to even the casual reader. But the writing is clear and the story amusing, which is novel among many of today's writers. A final complaint, Ewan is a very witty writer, which is delightful, but the self-satisfied amusement with which he and Howard regard each new witty comment distract from the story and grow mildly irksome as the book progresses. Although I wouldn't buy this book, perish the fool, it spiced up a dull afternoon, and I have great hope that Ewan will eventually become subtler about his literary abilities, which will make his stories many more times enjoyable. And I have great hope that some awful thing becomes so bad.
And Helen?
Mine's an Amazon review, and it says, Dead Lovely is about as Scottish as the Great Barrier Reef. The author's breathlessly gushing style is unmistakably Antipodean, so all her characters sound like they come straight from the script of Neighbours.
Well, thank you for those. Okay, the first question to all the panel. As we're talking confessions, have you ever done anything illegal?
Who's going to fess up first?
They're already all looking at me. Likely call.
I used to, I had a long distance relationship and I lived in London and my boyfriend, now husband, lived in Glasgow and I was very, very poor and I never used to buy a ticket on the train. So my trips from London to Glasgow were spent in various toilets in the train. And my husband, who's very law-abiding, I would say to him, don't meet me at the platform, just meet me outside. So I'd get off the train and kind of run away and meet him outside and not tell him. So that's not my worst one, but that's all I'm telling you.
Anybody else have anything illegal to own up to? Would you prefer that I move on swiftly?
Sadly, no. Nothing to say.
I could own up to something, but when I was 18 and very, very drunk, I was arrested with some of my friends for trying to steal a lamppost. it was a particular lamppost that we had a vendetta against, but for reasons that would take too long to go into. But we were all very drunk. There were about four of us, and we rocked it back and forth. It's fairly sort of straightforward to steal a lamppost, even though it seems like a momentous thing. We managed to get it to 45 degrees and obviously destroyed the pavement. I'm not condoning this activity, but we couldn't get it out, and we were so paralytic that we decided, well, that's it, we can't do it, and we just sat down, and the police turned up. Police turned up about 5 minutes later, so yes, I was arrested for attempted theft of a lamppost.
A heinous crime if ever there was one. What about being a victim of a crime?
Steve?
Again. Well, Don is asking me this because I got burgled on Tuesday night just before coming here. Oh. So yeah, it's not a very funny story or anything like that. But yeah, I got woken up by a neighbour at 7 in the morning, and the front door was open and all our stuff had been taken. So my wife and I and our son were asleep upstairs the whole time. Got downstairs, found all laptops, TVs, PlayStation, everything taken, and they trashed the place. So it was kind of an unhappy story. Does anybody have a happy victim of crime story?
I've been burgled twice when I've been in houses, but on neither occasion was my stuff nicked. It was always my housemates. And once I was in the flat with the burglar, unbeknown to me, who was taking my flatmate's jewellery box and everything, and I happened to be in the shower when they left because I was singing, and I heard the door slam as they left. But yeah, I've never had my stuff nicked coincidentally.
Just too
cool.
Perhaps you need better stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe so.
Douglas, you've written a series of 7 books about Barney Thompson, a serial killing barber in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. Even if it does start out that he's a serial killer by accident, he changes as the series evolves. When you started, did you have any idea that he would run and run? And also, is Final Cut really the last one?
I didn't start intending that it would run and run. That kind of just happened as it does. And he's a very dour, miserable Glaswegian that he's not proactive in any way. Bad stuff happens to him, and he just... And God, that was depressing, writing that after 3 books. So I kind of did a Blackadder type thing. You remember Blackadder, the first series of Blackadder, Rowan Atkinson's the put-upon one, and he's rubbish and miserable, and Baldrick's the one with all the comments. And obviously Rowan Atkinson thought, well, enough of that, I want to be a Serbic and cool. So he changed to be a Serbic and cool. I've kind of done that with Barney Thompson. I used a brain in a jar plot device where Barney dies and his brain gets put in a jar, and then he comes back and he's much cooler. He's much more like Blackadder 2 than Blackadder 1.
And is Final Cut the last one?
Well, possibly not. Okay. Depends.
Chris, we've heard all about Steve's horrible burglar story. You write a series about a burglar.
I know. I'm trying to pitch it to you now.
How would you feel if it turned out that your burglar was inspired by you?
He's not, because apparently he drilled the lock, rudimentary stuff.
Charlie just wouldn't do that. In your latest book, The Good Thief's Guide, Charlie meets someone who's a better thief than he is. You're continually upping the stakes for him. Is that something that you do consciously, or are you just mean?
No, I did want to. Basically, Charlie's always breaking into other people's places and stealing things, and I just wanted to turn the tables and see how he'd react if somebody did that to him, but not only if somebody burgled him, but also if they stole his most precious possession, which is his signed copy of the Maltese Falcon, which he thinks it's this kind of talisman whenever he's writing a book. He thinks this is what enables him to write. So that's stolen from him, but to make matters worse, it's stolen by a very glamorous female cat burglar who Charlie has the hots for. And she's sort of better than him at basically everything that he does. And so I wanted him to have this kind of cat and mouse chase around Venice with her, but being stumped at every point until ultimately Charlie triumphs. So yeah, that was the idea behind it.
Okay. Helen, is it true that your children often ask you to stop talking about murder?
Yes, yeah. My husband's a writer as well. And at the dinner table, we're often talking about how best to dissolve a body or stuff like that. And my son recently said, can you just write something with joy in it? And I said, yes, but she will die horribly.
You've got a teenage daughter and you also write teen fiction. Do you get any inspiration from her, or would you rather not know what she gets up to?
Oh, no, I'd rather not know, but I do get help from her, but I have to pay her. So she reads, she just read a draft of a book that I'm doing. It's really, really helpful. She says, that's ridiculous, Mum. No one would say that, and no one would wear that. And, you know, so she's very helpful, actually, but I do have to pay her for it.
Steve, for me, your books are at heart all about relationships. And your latest one, Black Flowers, has several strands of the relationship of several children, some now adult, with their fathers. Was that something which came out of you being a father, becoming a father?
Yeah, probably expecting to be a father at the time that I was putting the book together. And the main character in the book is also expecting to become a father as well. Out of him and the female protagonist, who's a detective, both have just lost their fathers at the beginning of the book. And so it is kind of about that. It's also a kind of serial killer thriller, but it's about fiction as well at heart. It's about a fictional book that's been written by this man, and he's drawn from real life in order to create this fiction. And the serial killers kind of come after him, and writing about it has ended up sort of fact has become fiction, has become fact, all intertwined, and the main character ends up investigating that. So it's kind of like an ongoing cause and effect process I was looking at. So it was natural to have children in there as well. It's also kind of, you know, as horrible as it is, it's sort of a love letter to fiction and storytelling, mm-hmm. in a way. The main character's father is a writer, and he wants to be one too. So it's all about all those things coming together. But yeah, my wife was expecting at the time, and there is some of that angst in there, you know, the kind of concern about what kind of father you're going to be and what parenting is going to be like, and that, you know, kind of have this blank canvas that arrives, and you know, what are you going to paint on it? How are you going to be? So all those things kind of came together, I think, in a weird kind of way.
No, I did. So this is a question for all of you. What is your most embarrassing moment? Chris?
I made the mistake of telling Donna this story in the bar last night, and I'm really not sure I should be telling it to a room full of people. But it was, I don't know, some years ago now, when I was training to be a lawyer and in Nottingham, and I was sharing a house with my now wife, and we'd been friends for years. She was training to be a teacher, and our parents, our families, and our friends were always saying, you know, are you two together? Is there something going on? And we'd always be like, no, there's nothing going on. But since we'd moved into this house, something had started to go on. And I came home from law school one day, and parked outside the house was a car. And out of the car stepped Joe, my wife's parents, who said, we've come for a surprise visit. Won't that be fun for Joe? And I immediately panicked and thought, I have to play this cool and not give anything away. And Joe wasn't home from teacher training school yet. So I said that I would give them a tour of the house, which they hadn't seen previously where we were staying. So I showed them around the ground floor, and then I took them upstairs. And it was only a small house. It had a bathroom, had a small box room, and it had a much larger bedroom at the front. And the deal when we'd got the house was that I was going to have the box room and Joe was going to have the big room. But when we'd got there, none of my furniture, conveniently enough, had fitted. So we'd switched. And so I took Joe's parents upstairs and I said, obviously this is the bathroom, and I took them into the box room and I said, this is Jo's room, and I was sort of explaining how that had come about, that she was in the small room. And then we walked into this massive front room at the front of the house, and I thought I have to basically say, this is where Jo got a bit shortchanged on the rental agreement. But instead, I stupidly walked into the room and sort of swept my arm around it, taking in the double bed, and said, "And this is where Jo gets screwed." Bad. And I didn't play it very cool. I just went bright red.
Anyone else have an embarrassing moment they want to share?
I've got one. I was going to a funeral with my husband, burying his great auntie, and we were very frazzled because my son on the way had gotten car sick and vomited all over the place, and we were cleaning and changing clothes, and for some reason anyway I ended up with my husband's phone. We get to the site of the grave, and the first embarrassing thing was that I think the guys who were the grave diggers thought I was a man, because they said, "Would you hold the rope that lowers it?" I thought, I'm supposed to ask girls that, but I just said okay. So I grabbed it, started lowering the coffin with the other people, and my husband's phone goes off halfway through. Da da la da 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 da. And there was nothing I could do because I had the rope, so I just had to wait for it to ring out.
Douglas?
I was sitting here struggling to remember, think of anything until that story from Helen there, and I did when our son was christened, and we're in a church in Froome, and he vomited beautifully over the gown that had been passed down through the generations, and I said fuck very loudly. And then my wife and I just sat and pissed ourselves laughing.
Steve?
Yeah, I've been struggling to think of one as well, because I don't really get embarrassed so much, believe it or not. But I can think of one awkward moment when I used to work at an insurance company for car insurance, and they used to have me ring up garages to talk about the repairs that were due to cars, and you would always get reception, so you would immediately say, "Hi, it's so-and-so from Direct Line, Steve from Direct Line," I wouldn't say so-and-so, "Steve from Direct Line, can I speak to your body shop, please?" And one of the other people played a prank on me by switching the telephone numbers round on the report, so I rang up and said, "Hi, it's Steve. Can I speak to your body shop?" And there was a pause, and the woman on the end of the phone said, "This is a mortuary." I'm dreadfully sorry.
Chris, your protagonist, Charlie Howard, as well as being a thief, is also a crime writer who talks about the books that he writes. And at one point in the latest book, he says that because of his friend and agent Victoria, who has great faith that his books will reach a far wider audience, he has decided to attempt the kind of ambitious thriller I might never have tried otherwise. How about Chris Ewan? Does he have an ambitious thriller in the drawer?
It's funny you should say that. No, I have been writing a standalone thriller to try and do something different, because obviously the Good Thief's Guides are more kind of comic crime fiction, and I wanted to try writing more sort of straight crime fiction. So I have written a kind of thriller called Safe House, which is set on the Isle of Man where I live, and yeah, I'm just in the process of finishing that at the moment, and I've really enjoyed it. It's nice, strange at first writing a manuscript and not trying to put a gag in every other sort of paragraph, but it's useful, because then when you come back to doing the sort of Good Thief's Guides, you're fresh to those as well. But yeah, I'd love to do more like that. I really, really enjoyed it.
Okay. Douglas, you've also written a political thriller called Lost in Juarez, which is about a children's author who anonymously publishes an anti-government book about the restriction of civil liberties. When the book's banned, he finds himself targeted by various different agencies and has to go on the run, which the whole book's about it being extremely difficult to do that in this Big Brother society. Where did that one come from, and do you have any plans for another along those lines?
I think it probably just came from, I actually wasn't living in Britain at the time that I wrote it. I was living in Poland, but I watched it, I didn't speak any Polish, so it wasn't like I watched Polish news, so I'd be watching British news, and I did get kind of aerated and kind of worked up about it, but there's part of me, I was kind of brought up by very conservative, with a capital C, parents who, well, not that it was a conservative government bringing all that stuff in, but there's part of me thinking, yeah, that's kind of fair enough, and my wife So I was writing all this stuff and not absolutely sure that I was as annoyed about it as I sound in the book, which kind of put a bit of a break on it. But I just went for it because it is what it is. There was no point in trying to make out actually the right to go after them because they're not in the story. So it was a bit funny writing it. It was writing something that I didn't entirely believe in, and I hope that doesn't come out.
No.
And I enjoyed writing it, but it's funny doing something where you're not just doing jokes all the time, because mm-hmm. the Barney Thompson books are just utterly bizarre. I just make shit up, and there's no research. When I was doing Lost of Our Res, I found myself researching all this legislation, and people don't know legislation, and I was just thinking, why don't I just make it up? Nobody knows what the actual legislation says anyway. But you kind of feel you have to, because if you're grounded in reality, which what Juarez is. So I found it harder. I'm not sure I'll ever do that again.
So you prefer writing the comic crime?
I prefer making shit up.
Steve, Black Flowers also has a fictional book as part of the plot. And there are several passages actually quoted from that book. And it seems to me as though you're exploring the whole idea of violence and crime fiction and writing about death and murder, is that right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I've written sort of 6 books now, and they've all been quite sort of violent, and you know, it's obviously it's a violent genre that, and the crime is often used as entertainment, crime thrillers and so on, but obviously crime is a real life thing that has an incredible, as I know only too well now, a real effect on people, and so I think that it's fairly natural, for me at least, to kind of worry about that a little bit, and to kind of ponder what it means. And so Black Flowers, yeah, it has this, the book sections that are included through it are extracts from a book called The Black Flower, which forms part of the plot. But they're actually, as you go on, you realise that they're actually really, it can be read as historical sections. They're almost flashback sections, because the man who wrote it has based it on real events. And what happens is, I think, it's very, very easy for us as writers and readers of crime as well to kind of touch this stuff at a very sort of safe distance. It's almost, you know, we're fascinated with the dark side and we want to kind of examine it, but we don't want to get too close, and we certainly don't want it to touch us back. So I came up with this character who's quite an arrogant writer, who thinks that he can take these events and kind of shape them into something, into his masterpiece, or, you know, that he can then be admired for. And what he finds is that the serial killer that he's based the story on discovers the book and begins to turn aspects of it into real life as well, comes after him, and that's still having an effect on various people, you know, 20, 30 years later, as the main character comes into it and has to deal with all this. So it's kind of about fiction being drawn from fact and the repercussions that can have. It's just an interesting thing to examine, I think. It was just what was in my head at the time. And I did it before a bit with a book called Still Bleeding, which was the one before, which is about representations of murder that you find online, like at true gore sites and shock sites and things like that. So it was looking at that and trying to draw comparisons between the people in the book who are very, very bad people who are getting off on that kind of material, and where's the line, dividing line between that and people like me who enjoy reading and writing fictional crime. You know, so just these things that are interesting to me.
Okay, thank you. And Helen, Steve talked there about drawing fiction from fact and the bad things that happen. You used to work with sex offenders. Obviously that must have changed your view of the world, but did it affect your fiction, which is actually quite full of humour?
Mm. Probably. I mean, one of the things I found working in the job in the end was in the prison in Balinny in Glasgow. I was a social worker there. And what I found was just how much humour was needed to cope with the job by the prison officers. Police say the same, and by social work. You know, that the grim stories that you're getting every day, meeting guys who had abused children or, you know, raped and killed, we really needed to go back to the office and have a good old laugh. And the humour was outrageous and black, like it is in Glasgow, and absolutely necessary. And I think that's where it comes out in the book. I mean, also the offenders were funny. You know, I mean, they've done awful things, but they've also got a lot of other aspects to their person. And quite often some of the things that they told you, the way they told you their stories, not about the crime itself, but about their lives, were very, very funny. So yeah, I think it definitely affected the way that I write.
Well, this is your chance to apologise for something that you've done in the past. What would it be? Helen, I'm going to start with you, because I know know that you once left your little sister to be gored to death by a bull?
Yeah, sorry, Rhea. Yeah, we lived in a town in country Australia, and up the road were the sale yards, and this dangerous bull got out one day. And my sister had bright long red hair, and we were out in the garden, and the bull got into our garden and sort of started, you know, from about 20 feet away doing that thing with its foot. And Rhea's hair, you know, this bright red was kind of flagging it to come towards her. So my response was to run into the house and lock all the doors.
Does Sorry. Anybody else have anything to apologise for, or have you all led blameless lives?
Sure, plenty, but I can't think of it at all.
It's not really the forum for apologising for shouting at your kids, really, is it?
Chris, Charlie's next outing is to Berlin, and he's going to be staying in one of my favourite parts of the city. Before you go for the first time to a city and do your research, or what the rest of us would call going on holiday, how much do you know about the plot? How many times do you tend to visit the location, and have you ever had any strange experiences while you're there?
I do know, I mean, I never know too much about my plot, so I always know a kind of premise to kick off with. But that is why I go on a trip to the cities, is to try and flesh out all that stuff. But I know the opening of Berlin, the basic idea is that Charlie is, something's been stolen from somebody and they want it back, and from the British Embassy, in fact, and they hire Charlie to help them as a kind of on Her Majesty's Secret Service. But the item's so sensitive that they won't tell Charlie what it is that he's trying to find and burgle back. And so he sort of breaks in, trying to figure out what it could be in these various different locations. So I had that hook, but I had no idea where he lived, and I had no idea of the kind of geography he'd be going around. So I go, admittedly, the first trip to a city as a kind of holiday, and I just get a feel for a place. And Berlin I found particularly difficult. Venice, I mean, everyone knows kind of, you know, what Venice is like. As soon as you mention it, it conjures up images, but Berlin's a much harder city to deal with. So that first visit, I sort of went as a tourist. And then the second visit, I'd got about a third of the way into a first draft. So I knew that Charlie would be living in Prenzlauerberg in the former East District. So I went and found his apartment and filmed that, and filmed some table tennis tables where he has a clandestine meeting with somebody. And then I sort of wander around and find the next place. British Embassy is going to be tough to get into, I think, based on what I've seen so far. But yeah, it's kind of a mixture. I think I get ideas when I see particular places, and obviously I try and build in certain landmarks or interesting places in a city and set a scene there where I can. So it's a kind of mixture of the two.
Okay, thank you. Douglas, on Monday of this week, you wrote on your blog, on Friday, I'm appearing on two panels at Crime Fest. I have to write the opening of a story involving animals for one of them, but I haven't done so yet. A, how important is having an online presence for you and for a writer these days? And B, don't you think that was cutting the homework a bit far?
B first, well, I kind of knew what I was going to do at that point. I completely changed my mind. I had to write the film script for The Long Midnight of Barney Thompson, and the opening line in the script was, "Is this your husband's penis?" Which is a great opening movie line, and unfortunately the film didn't get made and somebody else has now written the script. So I've just got this line lying around, "Is this your husband's penis?" So I was going to start with Nella the Elephant looking at a penis and trying to decide whether it was her husband's penis. So that was my first idea, and that was when I was confidently writing that on Monday. I had my thing, and then that didn't quite work, so I did the other thing. Online presence, I guess it's pretty huge, but I don't really know. I don't really speak to other writers and know what any of them do. So,
but
I enjoy it. I mean, it's more the blogging thing. I just enjoy it. And I've got a small devoted readership. But it's a bit like writing. It's kind of very similar to what I do when I write a Barney Thompson book. And I just make stuff up and write about what I feel like writing that day. If I'm not writing a Barney Thompson book, you've got the blog. And I very rarely write about writing. As you know, because you look at it, I just write about whatever, Eurovision Song Contest, whatever that happens that day.
Yeah, I mean, of all the authors on the panel, you're the one that most regularly updates their blog, and you put a lot on there, so there is a lot of information out there.
Yes.
Steve, in Black Flowers, you thread together various strands of appearance versus reality. In Cry for Help, you look at the responsibility that we have for others. And in The 50-50 Killer, you take the theme of the choices that we make and the implications that they have. Do you start each book with a particular theme in mind?
Usually, yeah, I've usually got an idea. With 50-50 Killer, that was clearest, I think, probably. But I mean, I think that each book usually starts in a different way, and it usually gets written in a different way as well. I don't really have any kind of set routine. I wish I had a way of doing things, but there is usually either a scene or something like that occurs to me, and an underlying premise, something that it stands for, almost a kind of metaphor below the surface or subject matter below the surface that keeps me interested. So with Black Flowers, it was the fact and fiction, the mingling of that, coupled with there was a video for a Peter Gabriel song called Digging in the Dirt, which I don't know if any of you know it. But that I saw that when I was quite young, and it really, really stayed with me. And one of the images in it is mushrooms, I think, growing in the shape of a body on the ground. And that kind of intrigued me, the idea that a body could be buried and affect the environment in that way, even after death. So again, that fed into it. At the moment, the next one is kind of going to be a bit different, because that's, having said what I said before about real life events, it's kind of slightly inspired by real life events as a jumping off point. There were some serial murders in the Ukraine in 2007. I think it was around 27 people were killed in a very short period of time by two teenagers. So I thought that was kind of an interesting jumping off point to go from, to have that many murders occur in quite a short book length. And that's kind of now become about cause and effect and the explicability of crime and everything like that, and other things coming together. So there's usually one idea, one theme, some scenes, some ideas, and other things stick to them as I write. I write the first draft, and then I figure out what it is that I'm actually writing about.
Okay, thank you. And Helen, your forthcoming book is called The Donor, and like Steve's, it seems to be about the choices we have to make. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, it's probably what I would call a moral dilemma thriller, and it's about a single father who's got twin daughters at the age of 16, and they're diagnosed with kidney disease. My agent described the book as Sophie's Choice with Kidneys, because he's on a quest to find these girls a kidney. The waiting list is very long. They'll probably die if they wait for a living donor on the NHS. So he goes through the various options of whether to buy one, trying to find the wife, the mother that disappeared when the girls were babies, killing himself, choosing between them. And what there are a lot of things I found interesting about writing it, but one of them was the parental aspect, having two children who you have very different relationships with but love equally. And of course in the book there's another option that is so terrible he'd never want to know. So anyway, so that's it.
Okay, thank you. A question for all the panel before I throw it open to the audience for questions. What was the worst book signing you've ever been to, or the most embarrassing happening at a book signing, or weirdest email from a reader that you've had?
I had someone say, write something rude on, and I was in Waterstones and it was a book launch, and I had one of those big thick black pens they'd given me, so I wrote, fuck you. And she was really, really pissed off.
Did she buy the book?
She walked off with it, really didn't want, I don't think she read it, she had already bought it.
You wrote something really rude in the front of the book he signed for me last year as well. Did so I? Rude that I can't even repeat it in this room.
Did you ask me to?
Yeah, I think you told me that story. Oh, right. I was like, yeah, write me something rude, and you did.
Anyone else had any weird communicational experiences?
I did this, I mentioned this in my blog yesterday when I was talking about this. I did a reading in southern Serbia to an audience of 120 Serbs, very few of whom I imagine spoke English. They were just there because there's nothing else to do in southern Serbia on a Friday evening. And it was in an area that had been quite widely targeted by NATO in 1999. And I was introduced as having worked at NATO in the 1990s, which I had, but I hadn't pressed any buttons or made any decisions. I'd made the tea and the coffee and swept up. So I read for an hour, complete silence. I'm doing my best Scottish jokes, which of course, I mean, they're very respectful, and it's nice that they all turn up to listen, but I mean, nobody gets any of the jokes. I throw the thing open to questions, and a guy stands up and asks me to justify Britain bombing Belgrade in 44 and 99.
What
I I
did
said
you say?
I said no. Our ambassador was sitting in the front row, and I should have opened the Mr. Ambassador, but I didn't, and I just said no and moved on.
Wow, can't top that.
You've never bombed Belgrade.
No.
Steve, I know you get a lot of strange search terms on your blog.
Oh yeah, I've not brought any with me though, so I can't. They're usually because of the dark subject matter, you kind of get some disturbing ones. But then also people send messages and things like that through the search terms, because you know you can see what somebody's typed into Google to arrive at your site. So people will say things like Steve Mosby is a dick or something like that. That will lead to my site, and I'll look and I'll see all these kind of messages sent to me from people. That happened for a while.
Do they not bother just sending you email?
Well, it's anonymous, you see. So it's you can't see who they're from. But I mean, in terms of you mentioned embarrassing book signings, Peter James isn't in the room, is he? He won't be. Last year at Harrogate, I was on a panel with him, and we all did the signing afterwards. And so I was sat next to him, and he had an enormous snaking queue of people, obviously coming to sign books for him, and nobody came to sign for me. Well, yeah, a couple of people dotted around it, but yeah, I was sitting there for most of the time, and at one point he turned to me in between books, nudged me and went, "Don't worry, it won't always be like this."
Oh. There is a book room outside.
I've got a good search engine one. I did a blog in Warsaw where they put up this enormous pedigree chum. It was just called Pedigree in Poland. And they used a male dog, so there was this enormous male penis in an advert up in this thing. So I just did this thing about this enormous male penis that just confronted us every morning on the way to school. And quite a few people found my blog by putting dog dildo into a search engine. Who's searching for dog dildo?
The same people that are searching my blog for nymphomaniac nuns. Helen, talking about...
Yeah, my Google one. I wrote a teenage book called Amelia O'Donoghue is So Not a Virgin. And I looked up the Kindle store, it's only in America, and I was really excited to find that it was number one under like seven subcategories. But you know, it was doing really well in the Kindle store. And then you go down a little bit further and say people who bought this item also bought. They bought the panty-teasing niece, you know, my naughty daughter, you know, stepfather's confession and the family man. So the paedophiles were buying my book, which, you know, is awful, but it was selling really well.
And on that note, does anyone have any questions?
I'd like to know how you all feel now about your first published book. Kay. Do you lose it in cringe, or are you still quite proud of it?
Okay, the question was, how do you all feel now about your first published book?
I feel really affectionately towards my first book. I cringe a little bit because I didn't know what I was doing. It was a little bit all over the place. But I also think because of that, it was more inspired than any of the ones since have been. So it's probably my great love for my first book.
I was very naughty because I published an edition of it myself, and I took all the bits that I hated out. That's just probably really bad, isn't it?
No,
but I kind of tidied it up, and if there was any clunking prose or what I thought was clunking prose, I thought, I'll just change that.
Is that because it's easier to do that now if you do it yourself?
Yes, yeah. But I mean, it was when I first wrote it, quite a lot of broad Glasgow in it, which I've come to not like, and I've stopped doing it. So I kept words like heed the ball and stoter and stomach, mm-hmm. all those great mm-hmm. Scottish words, but I took out the Wisney and Goney. And
mm-hmm.
so.
I've got real affection for Good Feast Guide, so I'm still. I still, each time I go back to write a Good Feast Guide, I read the opening of that book and try and do something similar, because I like the opening of that book. But the one thing I would change if I could is that because I was published by winning a competition, Susan Hill very graciously run this Lombard competition, and it was a small publisher, the book that you read that came out in paperback as well, that's just my manuscript. It was never edited or copy edited, and there's quite a few bloopers on just, I refer to a suitcase having a grisly secret inside it at one point, and I spout it as though it's a grizzly bear. So if I could get rid of those few niggling typos, I'd be very happy.
Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the others, I feel kind of affection towards my first book, more so than the people on Amazon. Those were the reviews for my first book. You know, and it's a bit muddled and everything, but but it was, you know, it was written before I had a publishing deal, and it was very heartfelt. So for all its flaws and everything like that, it's very different from everything I've done since. You know, for all its flaws, I kind of like it. It you know, meant something to me, the story. That's why I was writing it. And so yeah, it's not the best book in the world, and it's very, very different from what I write now.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's kind of, yeah, it has a special place.
Question was, who would you like to narrate one of your books for the audiobook version? Anyone have any thoughts?
It's just happened to me about 2 weeks ago. There's a guy, Audio Go in the States, have recorded it, and there's a British actor who was a Radio 4 presenter called Simon Vance, who I believe does a lot of audiobooks. He did the Stieg Larsson trilogy in the States, at least, and he's just recorded it, and he's got a really interesting website, actually, if you're interested in audio books, where he keeps a kind of video blog, and he shows you his sound room and how he does all the work and everything, and I think it's quite interesting. But when I spoke to him on the phone, he sounded exactly how I'd imagine Charlie to sound. You know, he's quite posh, British, very well spoken. And so probably him. I know that's a terrible answer, but it just seemed like a perfect fit. So yeah, I was really pleased with that.
Actually, I always think Charlie sounds like you when I'm
really.
Reading it.
A bit southwest.
Anybody else have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm thinking my Amazon review is right, actually, because although the characters in most of my book are female Scottish, I hate the females. I like male Scottish accents, but I don't like the sound of female Scottish accents in film and. Sorry, Donna. Bloody awful. So I don't know, because I can't think of anyone, and the problem has been that with casting as well, when we've been doing, you know, haven't had it optioned with TV and stuff. Who would you get that I would like to actually hear? I don't know.
Douglas or Steve, do you have any thoughts on that?
He's not Scottish, but Simon Pegg. I love Simon.
Mm.
Simon
yeah.
Pegg just walks into a room and I'd laugh, so I'd have Simon Pegg, and he's fantastic.
Actually, I can see him. It's Barney Thompson.
I really don't know, to be honest. I mean, I can't think of a sensible answer, but I'd like to hear Tom Baker. Tom Baker have a go at it and maybe narrate his opinions on it as he was going. I think that'd be good. Big booming voice.
Any other questions?
Sorry. It's interesting you say Simon Pegg, because he did a very interesting Scottish accent as Scotty in the last Star Trek.
Yes.
But I was going to ask Chris, actually. You know that review you read out earlier that you were so proud of?
Yes.
When your thriller is published, would you like this same reviewer to read?
not based on what she thinks about, you know, mystery fiction in the opening paragraph, which I haven't read yet. Who knows? It'd be nice to think it got published. Maybe Faith could have another crack at it. We'll see.
Any other questions?
For a run, that helps me.
So the question is, if you're having a bad day with writing, is there anything that you do to get over that?
Yeah, and I running helps me. I always work out a chapter and write out a chapter on the treadmill.
I don't really have good days at writing. Does anybody have good days at writing? I mean, some days are harder than others, obviously, but I find that the best thing to do is just to crack on with it. I mean, if it's really, really stumbling block and you really can't think what to do, then maybe just give it a rest and try not to worry and stress about it, because that won't help. But for me, it's just sitting down. I want 1,000 to 2,000 words a day when I'm writing, and I'll get them. And I don't care if they're rubbish, you know, because you can edit them at the end, but I want to always be moving forward. So, you know, as hard as the day is, just keep typing, because you can always delete it at the end. It doesn't matter. And it's better to be writing something than doing nothing, I think.
Yeah, on that note, it's really depressing to start a book at about the same time as Steve.
I know.
Because you'll get the occasional update on Twitter, and Steve will be twice as far ahead as you are.
Did you orchestrate the burglary so they could take my laptop? Foil, foil
catch
my
up. I've got a Labrador who sits on a bed right behind me when I'm writing and tries to sleep and snorts when I'm typing too loud, and then goes and gets a tennis ball that she drops by my feet, and so I have to to go and throw that, but also if it's not going well, I just go outside and lob the ball for 10 minutes or so, and that sort of clears my head. That's my tip.
And finally, I saw the wee balding guy in the second row there. He's my dad. Basically wants to know how much sex you had when you came.
There are a few differences between me and Bronnie as the woman. She was a virgin when she arrived in London for a start. And there were women, there was a woman tied up in the basement. If that was the case when I lived in the squat in London, then I'm really sorry because I never found her and I never heard her. She's probably still there. Quite a lot of it. I did come over to London with 50 quid in my pocket with a one-way ticket, having decided in Nepal that I shouldn't go back home. And so a lot of that very opening stuff was very autobiographical. But I didn't have Huntington's disease, and I wasn't a virgin, and I didn't kill anyone in the end. Yet.
Thank you. And on that note, I think we're out of time. So another prize for the best question.
Yes.
I get this at the end. So just remains to thank my panel for being so brilliant, and thank you all for